WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Gloria Steinem. Over the past 15 years, she's become a symbol of the women's movement. She's perhaps best known as the editor of Ms. Magazine, which she co-founded in 1972. In commemoration of its 15th anniversary, the editors of Ms. have put together a special double issue and a new book titled Letters to Ms. 1972 to 1987, for which Steinem wrote the introduction. In addition to her work as a journalist and editor, Gloria Steinem is a political activist. She co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus and Voters for Choice, a nonpartisan political action committee that supports pro-choice candidates. She's also active with various peace and disarmament groups. Steinem is the author of two recent books. One is an anthology of her essays titled Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. Her most recent book is Marilyn, Norma Jean, which is a feminist analysis of sex symbol Marilyn Monroe. Gloria Steinem, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Since Ms. is celebrating its 15th anniversary, why don't we start by looking back a little bit at the history of that magazine. You had already worked for several magazines as a journalist. Why did you think it was important to have a magazine written by and devoted to women?
Well, first, because even before I began to think about anything that might be called feminism or to question the structures that women encountered, I and lots of women could not write about political subjects for the existing magazines. We were thought to be the experts on, food, makeup, babies, and celebrities, but that was pretty much it. And though I railed against it, as many other women did, perhaps not hard enough in retrospect, but at least we tried, it really didn't budge very much. Then after we began to realize that there was a reason why women felt connected to other discriminated against groups and kind of identified with the underdog, because we were also underdogs, and there began to be a women's movement. Then the magazine said, well, you know, we published our article on feminism last year, or if we're going to write one article saying that women are full human beings, we'll have to publish one right next to it saying they're not in order to be objective. So it became more and more clear to lots of us that we could not either write what we wanted to or read or edit what we wanted to in the existing magazines. So we started to meet and discuss whether or not, you know, a magazine might be possible.
Did you find, too, that a lot of male editors thought that it was just too specialized, too narrow to write about issues like abortion or equality for women? Yeah, because all of their readers wouldn't be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And that was true on the left and on the right. You know, you would find, I'm sorry to say, is because I have much more affection for the left, but you would find left men editors who would say, well, you know, abortion is too controversial and we can't divide the left, quote unquote, with this kind of argument. Of course, it was actually much more popular as an issue than anything they were talking about. But still, that just wasn't it just wasn't serious in their view. There is still some of this going on, you know, absolutely. I mean, women are still viewed as a single issue, whereas men are the world. But it's greatly diminished, and when I think about the life of the magazine, I think partly about the fact that everybody said after the first issue, well, they've said everything they have to say. What is there to talk about besides child care and welfare is a woman's issue and, you know, a few other things, but that's it. You know, now what? I mean, so the movement and the magazine has been being pronounced over ever since the first story that I know of, the cover story pronouncing the women's movement over, was from 1969, before the magazine ever started.
Well, that was pretty premature.
Right.
What did you think the state of feminist coverage was in the mainstream media in the early 70s and late 60s?
It was mostly ridicule, really. Because that was the era of, quote, bra burners, unquote, an alliterative epithet invented by a guy from the New York Post who was actually covering the demonstration against the Miss America contest. And though nobody ever burned anything, although they did threaten to burn, a steno pad, a dust mop, an apron. They put all this stuff in a dustbin on the boardwalk. They were going to burn it, including a bra. But they never did because they couldn't get a fire permit. I mean, this is, you know, we're just much too docile, right? But But nonetheless, he picked up. He couldn't resist the alliteration, and that was symbolic of the kind of ridicule, really. So to move forward to serious opposition is ironically a step forward.
I think that women's organizations and publications functioned on two levels, especially at the beginning. One was that the content was going to be oriented toward women, and the other was this kind of utopian sense that with women at the controls, it was going to have a different structure, a different sense of power and hierarchy than their male-run counterparts had. Did that happen at Ms. Magazine? Did you have a sense of, you know, what the utopian women's-run magazine was going to be like? And I'm talking about
the
power structure.
We did, but it wasn't totally. It was somewhat wrong, but not totally wrong. For instance, when we started out, I mean, an example of our naivete was that we sat around, there were eight of us, and we sat around and we fixed each other's salaries, basically. Well, first, no, the real utopian thing was that we thought we should all have the same salary. But it soon became clear to us, just from knowing each other's lives, that that was not possible. Some of us were supporting children and some were not. Some were older and had been earning, you know, higher salaries in the past. So we did fix each other's salaries, but we took three things in mind. One, what our need was. Two, what our experience was. And three, how important we were to the life of the magazine itself. What we did do, though, was to try to, and something we've still maintained, to make sure that the top salary was no more than three times the lowest salary. So, you know, I think in a way that's a little microcosm of the both the idealism and the realism. That is, okay, no, we couldn't all earn the same salary, but yes, we could substantially change the way money was distributed so that the top was three times the bottom, which is very different from other magazines where the chief editor may earn, you know, $200,000 or more, and the secretary earns 10. You know, I mean, at least we narrowed the gap a lot.
Have you maintained any of those initial utopian ideals?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, I think that's very practical. We have maintained the kind of 3-to-1 ratio. And it is practical, and it does help. I mean, it doesn't make sense to make that much of a differentiation, I think, among people who are all contributing to the same thing. And we also, though the original, I'm sure, vision of us was all sitting around cross-legged on the floor voting on everything, which we could never do, of course. You know, every person can't read every manuscript and vote on it. It's just not possible. However, we have maintained a different kind of structure because, I mean, if you come to one of our editorial meetings, it's just real different from anybody else's editorial meeting because in the other ones, I mean, I've worked for practically every other women's magazine or any magazine, I think, in some time in my life, and their editorial meetings are always, everybody looks at one person, you know, at the chief editor to see, can I intrigue him or her? Am I pleasing him or her? Our meetings are not like that. The people are looking at and trying to persuade either the most resistant person or the person who knows the most about this subject matter. Whatever it is, it's quite different. And I think it's very important because instead of replicating the limitations as well as the virtues of one person, you have a chance to have the collective wisdom and strengths of the whole group.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, who is the founding editor of Ms. Magazine. Did you go through this phenomenon that when you formed this magazine with other women, that male colleagues of yours, male journalists, assumed that what you did all day was sit around and talk about men, complain bitterly about men?
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought about that in a long time, but you're completely right. I remember somebody saying to me at one of the networks, CBS, I think, that whenever three or four women had lunch together, that it made all the men nervous because they thought we were, you know, planning, midnight castration parties or something. I don't know. And I think that's true. You know, it's so threatening, oddly threatening, for a few women to be together. I do think that that's diminished a lot.
Do you think that your mission has changed in the 15 years that you've been editing Ms?
I think so. I mean, well, the overall mission is still to be a forum for the ideas of equality and how to get there, and for the fiction and poetry and, you know, all of the kind of creative, we do need art and poetry and everything, you know, if this is really going to be a full revolution. But the form that that overall purpose takes has changed, because in the beginning, we spent an awful lot of time proving that there was discrimination. I mean, it was really the popular notion that white women controlled the economy, that widows, you know, inherited, you know, all kinds of power and wealth, and that black women were matriarchs, thanks to Patrick Moynihan. So we did spend an inordinate amount of time doing big, big survey pieces. You know, what is it like to be, to really like to be a woman on welfare? What is it really like to be a woman on Wall Street? What is it really like to be a flight attendant? We had to prove that there was discrimination. And there we had to either name ourselves or report on those women who were naming problems that had had no name. Battered women, displaced homemaker, sexual harassment. So many things that had just had no names. They were just called life. You know, they were just thought to be normal. Changing rape to sexual assault, making clear that rape was not about sex, it was about violence. Differentiating between pornography and erotica, which, of course, is still not nearly done, you know. It was a process of proving what already existed and naming. I think now it's much more diverse, and I find exciting editorially, because it's not so much reaction as action. That is, we're more likely to be able to, instead of reacting to the discriminatory forces of society, report on initiatives that women are taking to live a different way. Maybe that's women starting their own businesses. Maybe it's women reorganizing the way the work is done in the home and trying to get it shared equally. Maybe it's women visual artists who have a whole different symbolic vocabulary. But whatever it is, it's a little bit more likely. I mean, I don't want to be overly optimistic here, but a little bit more likely to be moving forward instead of simply responding.
We're looking back at 15 years ago when you started Ms. Magazine, and I know you think many things have changed for the better since then, but I also know that you think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. You have an essay in the anniversary issue that opens with an anecdote where you describe a business friend of yours saying to you, well, you must be really happy the women's movement is over, and now you can move on to other things. And I think that that's a fairly commonly held attitude, mm-hmm. that we're in the post-feminist era, the era. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the New York Times has given us this term, post-feminist. Thank you very much.
Well, do you think that that feminism has done its job already, that equal rights have been won and now it's on to other things?
No, certainly not. And since, you know, just today or this week has been released a study of the status of American women now, financed by the Ford Foundation and done by the Congressional Women's Caucus, which shows that a college-educated woman working full-time still makes less than a male high school dropout working full-time. I mean, you know, we certainly have every kind of dramatic illustration before us that what we have done is to advance the dreams and the possibilities and the idea that women are full human beings, which is a first in history, perhaps, since our subordinate role was thought to be natural before. But we have not, clearly not, changed the structures, in fact. And we really, in a literal sense, have, if not just begun, I mean, we're still in the first quarter or third of this wave.
Do you think that in some ways, talking about how well feminism has done its work, equal rights have been won, that kind of stand is a justification of maintaining the status quo?
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, yeah,
absolutely.
The
battle's over, and now we can just go back and it's just do things as they've been.
It's just a different form of resistance, because in the beginning it was, as it is with all movements, that this movement is not necessary. You know, my maid doesn't like these Black Panthers. You know, my wife doesn't care about feminism, you know. And then after it turns out to be necessary, or at least, I mean, to be happening anyway, then the next move is to say, well, it's over. I mean, it used to be necessary, but it's not anymore. And I think we just have to expect that. In the 10th anniversary issue of the magazine, perhaps we should have done this again, I don't know. We did a no-comment spread. That's the kind of section of the magazine which we put things that are so bad they need no comment, of all of the, or some of the cover stories and headlines and so on declaring that the women's movement was dead. And the first one was in 1969. So this has been going on for a very long time. Now, the man that you describe and that, you know, who was not a friend actually, but, you know, a fairly typical
consultant.
Acquaintance, yeah. I said to him, well, you know, what makes you think the women's movement is over? Well, I see women everywhere, he said. I see them in my bank, my office, my... And I thought of saying to him that after all, these women were not... They were all working for him or at lower levels. They weren't at his own level, and certainly he was not working for a woman. But I thought maybe that didn't go far enough because he would just say, well, when women have been in the pipeline far, you know, that, you know, they just haven't been around long enough. So I said, well, do you see men raising children as much as women do, or, you know, doing the work of homemaking and so on as much as women do? Certainly not, he said, you know, shocked. You know, that will never happen. Is that what you want? You know, so I think we just need to advance our dreams and make the future vision, I don't mean as some kind of airtight utopia, but just future possibilities, let's put it that way, clear. And then we understand, we both release hopes in ourselves and we give ourselves a much better, more realistic idea of exactly where we are in the overall progress.
Gloria Steinem is my guest, and we're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Gloria Steinem is my guest. She's the founding editor of Ms. Magazine, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this month. And in celebration of it, it has a special double issue and also a new book of letters titled Letters to Ms. 1972 to 1987. Now, one of the big women's-related issues in the news now is the possible campaign of Pat Schroeder for the presidency. And I wonder how important the issue of a woman president is to you. And here's why I'm asking it. We've seen Margaret Thatcher be a head of state, and I don't believe she's been an activist campaigner for women's rights. Now, Pat Schroeder probably would be. But, I mean, you can't in politics necessarily equate being a woman with being a feminist and campaigning on the rights for the rights of women.
No, certainly not. I mean, there will always be people who look like us and behave like them. And in some ways, that's even more confusing. I mean, clearly there are black opponents of affirmative action, and there are women who oppose equality. And, you know, it's not by any means the majority. It's a small group, but it's inevitable. And it's somewhat inevitable that those folks may be chosen by the opposition first. But I do think that this country is in a slightly different situation from England, say, or from India, thinking of Indira Gandhi as the other most famous chief of state, because they have a stronger caste or class system than we do. I'm not saying we don't have one. We do, but not quite of the same depth. And therefore, the caste or class of a woman may mitigate the disaster of her being female. In other words, if Indira Gandhi had had a brother, she never would have been the prime minister. But since she didn't have a brother, her family was so important and the legacy of Pandit Nehru was so important that even the disaster of being a female was somewhat diminished. Similarly with Thatcher, she didn't stand for the majority hopes of women as a group. She stood for a class interest, basically. So that class interest mitigated the disaster of being a female, and she was elected. So you're more likely, excuse me.
Why don't you take a sip of water?
Okay.
I'll reintroduce you. My guest is feminist Gloria Steinem, who's a founding editor of Ms. Magazine and one of the leading feminist activists in America.
Thank you. We're
talking about women in politics.
So anyway, what happens in those countries is you're more likely to get a single woman in a top leadership position first. In this country, it takes longer by a lot, but you're somewhat more likely to get someone who actually represents the majority hopes of that particular group, at least in the second wave, if not in the first wave of leadership. Even having said that, however, it's important to remember that unless there's an organized constituency, nobody in the leadership position can do a whole lot because they will be pressured by the same forces that pressure the people already there. But I do think that, as Jesse Jackson has often pointed out, that the candidacies of, for instance, Shirley Chisholm as the first black and woman running for the presidency, Jesse himself, Geraldine Ferraro, and now Patricia Schroeder, have taken the white male-only sign off the White House in our minds, and that is the first step, and have also introduced new issues or issues into the public forum that would not be there otherwise. I mean, Pat Schroeder, I hope very much, decides to make the run. She's basing the decision on whether she can collect enough money to really make an effective run, because just her presence in the debates will make an enormous difference. She is much more expert than anybody else there on military and foreign policy questions. She's been on the Armed Services Committee for 14, 15 years, and of course on the issues of sexual equality is the same. And Jesse Jackson's, you know, presence in those debates makes an enormous difference too.
One of the early sayings in the women's movement was "the personal is political," and I wonder if that still has the same resonance for you now that it did in the late 60s.
It really does. I think in some ways we're only, you know how you learn something intellectually before it gets to you emotionally sometimes? Mm-hmm. I think it's just getting to us emotionally now.
How is it getting to you emotionally now?
Well, I guess, I mean, this may sound strange, but I'm just beginning to realize that I need to do some of the things that I have been saying should be done. In other words, I've been telling women, for instance, or trying to help women editorially know how to manage their money, to save money. Have I done this up to now? No, absolutely not. I mean, at no point have I had enough money to last more than a month or two, I don't think, because I was just having a much better time giving it away. But also, which is, I think, a positive reason, but also just because I didn't feel comfortable exerting that kind of control over money. I hadn't internalized the message myself. And I'm just beginning to try to do that. And there are all kinds of examples.
What's another one?
Well, just my own apartment. I mean, I've lived in the same apartment since 1962, so it's the very same two rooms. I turned it into a closet, basically, because once the movement was born, I was traveling so much. And I really didn't make a place for myself that was pleasant or supportive. And I realize in retrospect that I was kind of replicating my childhood. I happened to have lived a very chaotic, I mean, it wasn't my parents' fault. They did the best they could. But, you know, it was a kind of neglected, chaotic childhood. And I guess because it feels like home, because it's the only thing we have known, then we replicate it. Maybe it's what we want, but maybe it isn't. We have to realize that we can make a choice. And I'm just beginning to do that. So I think in a funny way, and I see this with other women too, perhaps especially with women who are married and have children, who were out there on the hustings, you know, campaigning and doing a lot of very valuable work, but hadn't changed the structures inside their own houses because that was harder, you know, in terms of their husbands and, you know, what was really going on. So in a funny way, is Corinne Horrible, who's a wonderful feminist in Minneapolis, who is married and does have children, she said to me, you know, we knew that the personal was political, but now I'm just learning that the political is personal.
Your grandmother was a suffragist and a delegate to a big international convention back in 1908. I wonder if that had any effect on you at all, because I should point out she's on your father's side, and I believe he left your mother and you when you were pretty young. So was there any feminist legacy passed on from her through the
family?
No,
there really wasn't, and I feel bad about that because it caused my mother to lead a less strong life than she might have otherwise, and because it caused me to waste a lot of time rediscovering the wheel. but also because it means that our lessons of today can be forgotten too. My grandmother, after the vote was achieved, stopped being active in the way that, you know, many suffragists did, out of exhaustion, out of lack of self-respect, out of, you know, I don't know why, but she did. So by the time I was born, she was not active, and since she died when I was very little, I never knew, really. And my family kind of inadvertently concealed what she had been up to. I mean, they would tell me how she was a wonderful woman because she founded the first vocational high school in Toledo. She raised four sons, and she kept a kosher table and so on. But they didn't tell me that she was this, you know, kind of raging feminist who marched in the streets and ran for the school board on a coalition ticket with the anarchists and the socialists. They sort of conveniently forgot that part.
Were they embarrassed by it?
I don't know. It wasn't conscious on their parts exactly, but I think it just wasn't socially good to have done this. So they didn't exactly conceal it, but they didn't talk about it. So it wasn't until a nice feminist in Toledo wrote a monograph about my grandmother and sent it to me that I had any idea of the scope of her activities.
You said that this worried you in a way because it meant that other families or other women can forget what happened before. Is that what you're afraid mm-hmm. is happening in the, quote, post-feminist period?
No, I don't think. I mean, that only began to happen after a century, and we're only, you know, 25 years or so into this, and it is not post-feminist, no matter what the New York Times says. It's just that young women, if the young women have a problem, it's only that they think there's no problem. And, of course, they will, you know, get educated by the world and by you know, what they meet in the labor force and when they have children and so on.
Gloria Steinem, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for visiting with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been feminist Gloria Steinem, who is a founder and editor of Ms. Magazine, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this summer. The magazine has put together a collection of letters titled Letters to Ms. 1972-87, published by Henry Holt. There's also a special anniversary edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.